Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hello, welcome along to Writer's Routine. This week, we're chatting to Erin Kinsley. Her new novel is Innocent. It's all about a local celebrity found dead in a close-knit community. Now, her debut, Found, was published to huge acclaim last year. Now, we talk about why every adjective has to earn its keep, which is quite niche. I love the fact that we're that niche straight away. Also, she explains why, if you feel like you should write a very specific book, then it's that project that needs to leap to the front of the queue. And also, you can hear why she doesn't, on the surface, plot too much, because it seems really that her subconscious takes care of most of that.
I was describing a little cabin, and I, in the opening scenes, I put a shotgun in this cabin, and I had no idea why I'd done that. And then way down the line, as I was getting to the closing scenes, it became crystal clear why that shotgun was there, and it was very much needed. But this was 3 or 4 months down the line. But I had subconsciously put that shotgun in there so that somebody down the line could pick it up. So I think your subconscious is always a lot smarter than you are, actually.
Also, it's a very special bumper episode this week. Towards the end, you can hear about a fantastic writing magazine. It's been written by someone who actually knows what readers want to know about books, which is always quite a head start, I think. We'll learn more about that in a bit. It's on the way with Erin Kinsley in this week's Writer's Routine. Yes, hello. Welcome along to Writer's Routine. This is the show that takes a look at how writers work, how they organise their time, their ideas and their plot to get that book done, to get it published, to get it out into the world. My name's Dan Simpson. Thank you so much for listening. If you are listening through Apple Podcasts, by the way, you can do us a favour, could you? Just spare a second. Leave us a review if you've not done that already. I promise it's so quick and it will really help others find us, which I think is a win all round. Now, this week, we're chatting to Erin Kinsley all about her new novel, Innocent. Her debut, Found, was published last year at a huge success and praise. And you can hear about the slightly harrowing idea for what led to that story, but why, when she had it, Erin had to get it out there. Now, Erin has just published her second book, the one she's here to talk about, Found. It's her second book under that name, Erin Kinsley. She's written many more under another name. I won't tell you what it is. That's our little secret. I will say that they're all Greek mystery stories. To be honest, if you want to do a little bit of digging on that, I'm sure you'll find it fairly quickly. We talk with Erin all about the discipline of writing, the form that her planning takes between diagrams and charts, the targets that she sets herself, how her work changes in the morning and in the evening, and why sometimes she works in pen and other times on the keyboard. Also, remember, I mentioned it a second ago, it is really worth you sticking around to the end of this podcast because we're chatting to Ed Needham, who is the editor of the amazing Strong Words magazine. I mean, if you love your books, and I mean, I guess you do love your books, that's why you're listening to this show. If that's you, really do stay to the end to hear more from Ed about the fantastic magazine. Before we get there, we need to get into it with Erin Kinsley, though, and talk about what she sees around her in the place where she sits down to write.
These days I tend to write, believe it or not, either in my old caravan, which is not very scenic, but has seen me through two books, and I have a view of open fields from there. But when it gets too cold, I tend to write in the bedroom, actually, where it's snugly and warm. I go and sit upstairs on the bed.
I'm always fascinated by writers who change up, who write in different places. Why is your starting point the caravan as opposed to the snuggly warmth of the bedroom all the time?
Because it feels like I'm entering the writing zone if I go out there. And to be honest, it's a bit easier to focus and kind of knuckle down to it. I feel like I'm going to my office. It's not much of an office. It's not very glam, but I've got a kettle in there. I've got the essentials. I've got my tea and my kettle and a bottle of milk. I try not to take the biscuit tin with me. You know, that's bad news, taking the biscuit tin. But it feels, I feel in that small space, I feel very cocooned in there. And I think that's why I think a number of writers do write in sheds and places like that. And there's something kind of womb-like about it, actually. You just really are entering the zone when you go in there.
Kind of being locked away with your ideas.
Yeah, very much so. And there's not very much going on. We're at the end of a very quiet lane here, so there's very few distractions. There's, there's the bird life, which I like to watch if I get distracted. But there aren't very many distractions. The other thing I don't have in the caravan is that I don't have Wi-Fi. And that is a definite plus for productivity because, you know, everybody knows the worst distraction in the world is the internet. The caravan doesn't have that. So if I go out there, I'm really, really cocooned from the world.
Well, what does the caravan have in terms of storytelling? I mean, if I were to walk in, would I have any clue as to the story that you are writing?
I think you probably wouldn't, actually. I have my bookshelves in there and I have hundreds of notebooks that's got notes from all kinds of things that I've written over the years, you know, great big stacks. I'm a bit of a sucker for pretty notebooks, you know, for paper chase and places like that, absolute magnets for me. And I have my fancy pens. I have to have the right pen to write. And I'm also fond of writing with a fountain pen, with good old fashioned bottles of inks. I've got lots of bottles of different coloured inks in there, but you wouldn't know what I was writing. I do tend to use a great big, you know, like a draftsman's pad of paper for doing diagrammatically where I'm going with the plot, especially when I get a bit further on, because it's very easy to lose track of progress. I need to remember who said what to who when. So you might see a plan stuck on the wall. But apart from that, no, I don't think you would have any idea actually what I was writing.
It's amazing, isn't it? I've done quite a few of these chats now, and I've trained my brain to pick up on the stuff that I really need to pick apart. And there was so much in that writing with fountain pens. Does that mean you're writing the whole time in longhand?
I like to do my first drafts in longhand because I think there is a different connection between the creative brain and the hand than there is between the creative brain and the keyboard. And I definitely write, I think, more interesting stuff when I'm writing with a pen in my hand. And then when I've written the longhand version in one of my notebooks, you know, there's loads of crossings out in there and revisions, and a lot of it is just kind of stream of consciousness stuff, actually. Then my first edit is to go and key that in to the laptop, and then I work on from there. But that's a way that works for me. It's worked for me for many years.
Have you ever tried to write your first draft on a computer?
Do you know what? Yes, I have. And actually found my first Erin Kingsley book, which has been a huge success. Interestingly, I did write that straight to the laptop. Now, what does that tell you about my writing style, actually? Perhaps what I've just said about...
This was only the last book, wasn't it? As in, so you're on your second novel, right?
My second Erin Kingsley novel. Not my second novel, but my second Erin Kingsley novel.
But that's interesting. So, like, I don't want to give too much away because you write under a pseudonym, so we're going to focus on that. But, right, I'm just trying to get the timeline correctly in my head. So your debut Erin Kingsley novel... this was found. You wrote that on the laptop, but then you went back to write, and that was a huge success. And then you went back to writing longhand for the second Erin Kingsley novel.
Yeah, do you know, I think there's a reason for that. The Found was a book that I had wanted to write for at least 5, maybe more years. and I was absolutely bursting to write it and had never found the time. And I think when I came to sit down and write it, it was just like it just came pouring out, and it wouldn't have been fast enough to write with my hand. I wrote it in 2 months, believe it or not, and that is the fastest by a long, long shot that I have ever written a book. And it came out almost perfectly formed on the laptop. So that, but it had this massively long gestation period where I was just thinking, I really should write that book. I really should write that book. And here's a message to everybody. If you're feeling like that about a book or a piece of writing, you really should write that book, and you really should put it to the front of your queue. It was the premise of it. It was inspired a long time ago by the Madeleine McCann case, because what I couldn't help thinking about that case was, what would happen if she was found? What kind of a state would she come back in, you know, and could she ever have a normal life? And to be frank, would she be better off dead, which is a terrible thing to say, but, you know, how damaged would a child be under those, you know, assuming she'd been grabbed by paedophiles or whatever? How badly damaged would she be? And could a recovery be made? And that was the premise of Found, you know, that with the right people, perhaps there is a possibility of some kind of normality. So that was the inspiration for that book.
And then you reverted back to writing longhand. I love the fact. So you said that you wrote that very, very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
How did you kind of plan the writing of that? Was it at such a point by the time you got it out that you could almost just sit there and stream of consciousness?
I just basically went and sat in the caravan on a daily basis, and it just sat and typed it. And it seemed like I did have those charts, and then when I was revising it, you know, my graphs and whatever, where it was going, where the action was going, what the characters were doing. But my intervention in that really wasn't that much required. I mean, I that was definitely the result of so much subconscious activity, I think, going on in the previous years, that it just ended up, you know, pretty much perfectly formed. Never had that before, probably never going to have it again, but it was a fantastic experience while it happened.
You speak of these diagrams and charts that you make. What form do they actually take? Would it be understandable to someone like me who can't see inside your brain if I opened up the notebook? Could I get a handle on what you are kind of figuring out here, or is it almost incomprehensible? It's this random shape that only makes sense to you.
I think you'd make sense of it. I'm big on colours, you know, my coloured inks and whatever. I think that's the creative part of my brain. So I tend to divide whatever book I'm writing, and this is certainly true of Innocent. I divide my work into strands. I think my books they tend to have a major plot and a subplot. And sometimes I write those separately and then weave them back in together. And sometimes I write them side by side. But with Innocent, I wrote them side by side and color coded the different strands that were running through the novel. You know, a red strand and a blue strand for the police, which seems a kind of obvious one, and a green strand for this character's line and whatever. And it draw a chart of boxes, you know, with the action and but coloured to the character that particular action is showing. So it looks like a bit of a rainbow mess, really. It's a bit like a Jackson Pollock painting with little boxes, I suppose. But you could figure it out, I think. There's an awful lot of arrows on those things, you know, this arrow leading here and a lot of crossed arrows. And a lot of crossings out and a lot of movings about. And I think that's the problem when you're writing a novel. It's an immensely complex undertaking. You know, when you write the first chapter, you think you know where you're going and it all seems fairly straightforward. And then thoughts come in and you think, oh, but it would be quite good if so-and-so happened. But you might have to backtrack to put the lead into that piece of action. You might have to go back right to the beginning or to a third of the way through, plug all that in. And I found that doing the novel diagrammatically, having a piece of paper to visualize it on one sheet of paper, I think that's the crucial thing for me, is that I need to see it on one sheet of paper. But it does become a very messy piece of paper by the time I finish the book.
Now, the show is Writer's Routine, Erin. So talk me through yours. The moment you wake up to the moment you go to bed, on a day when you are sat down to write in the caravan, how does it look?
Well, I tend to get up pretty early. I'm usually up by 6, and in summer I'm sometimes up by 5, actually. If it's a lovely summer's morning, my winter and my summer routine are very different. If it's winter, I'm really not keen to get out of bed, I have to say. I might stay in bed and read for an hour, even 2 hours, and I drink lots of tea. I mean, just assume throughout my day there is tea, because I'm a terrible tea addict. But there's dogs to be walked, and we have a few chickens. So my priorities are the animals, actually. The dogs, walk the dogs, feed the chickens, and then probably start work, go out to the caravan at about 8 o'clock. And early morning, I like to do new writing. I'm definitely a morning person. My other half is the most terrible night owl, and sometimes I kind of feel like, especially in summer, we cross, he's just about going to bed while I'm getting up. But I'm definitely a morning person, creativity-wise, and I tend to write new writing, you know, fresh words first thing in the morning. And I'll probably work till about 1 o'clock out in the caravan with my notebooks. And then
is that working straight, so 5 hours cracking it right through?
I would like to say that was the case, but if I'm honest, I would say possibly not. There might be the odd break, you know. I think you can get completely stifled if I'm immersed in something, yes, but usually I might come in and make a phone call, or, you know, I'm not set in there, set in stone for the whole morning usually. But as soon as I leave the caravan in that time period, I do feel guilty. So I know I should be writing. So I do tend to get myself back in there fairly quickly. Then there's a break for lunch at about 1 o'clock. And then from about 2 o'clock till about 4 o'clock, I work on edits, because I've still got a fair amount of brain power going on until about 4 o'clock. And I'll work on edits. I might work through what I've written that morning, or I might be working through a different manuscript entirely, or you know, doing blog posts or whatever. But I do non-new writing, what I call non-new writing, in the afternoons. And then 4 o'clock, I'm pretty much done for the day, to be honest.
How good are you at switching off at 4 o'clock? You've spent a considerable amount of time on your work. How are you good at just saying, that's it, I'll come back to you tomorrow at 8.
Do you know, I am really poor at switching off ever when I am writing a book, because I think it's always with you. You've got to carry it with you, and the house is littered with bits of paper with little scribbled notes on. I might have thought of a good turn of phrase or something that should happen in the action. And I tend to say I have my best ideas really when I'm doing the most mundane tasks, when I'm not actually writing. I think peeling potatoes is a great time to have good ideas, and doing the washing up or driving. You know, when I'm driving, I never have music on in the car, because I think there's something about the two levels of your brain. I talk about a lot about the creative brain, I know, but I think the levels of the brain are quite important. So when you're driving, it's kind of a mindless task, and that frees up your subconscious to be turning things over, the same as when you do, you know, when you're doing ironing or any of those tasks. And then quite often when I'm doing that, I will solve a difficult plot point or think that's what needs to happen next. And then I'll be running off again to the notebooks and might spend another 20, 30 minutes writing again. So I feel I'm never free of it. In some ways, it feels quite a burden, to be honest. Even, you know, even when I'm sitting down in the evening, should be relaxing, I might think, oh, do you know, I must write that down, because if I don't write it down, it'll go. You know, I'm kind of at that age now where I can't expect to hold on to ideas forever. I always sleep with a notebook by the bed, because sometimes I wake up with brilliant ideas, and I just think if you don't get them down in the moment, you lose them forever.
In that 5 hours of quite concentrated new writing time that you have, is there a goal for how much you'd like to get done? Do you know what you're going to write that day when you sit down in the morning?
I will not allow myself to stop until I've done at least 1,000 words. Mostly I'll do more than that. These days I can usually do at least 2,000, sometimes even more than that if I'm on a roll. Sometimes it's really difficult and I'm just not in the mood. And then the 1,000 words can be, you know, they can be very hard, and actually they're not very good. They're not even really usable. But there is definitely an element of discipline. Discipline is absolutely paramount in writing. You've got to show up, I think, on pretty much a daily basis. I do give myself weekends off usually, with the proviso I've just said that, you know, notebooks lying around the house and so on. But you have got to be disciplined. You've got to be there, and you've got to do your daily words, no matter what time of day you do that. When I was when my son was very young, I used to set my alarm for 4 a.m. to get up and have a couple of hours writing time, just to make sure that those words get done. So I have always been a very disciplined person, and that stays with me to this day. So I never stop unless I've crossed the 1,000 word barrier.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Very quickly, before we get back to it with Erin, I want to remind you, if you are enjoying the show and the wide range of authors that we're giving you, please do support us over at Patreon. It doesn't take a lot either. Just $1 or so a month really helps us out. It helps us keep bringing you chats with the best authors that we can find as often as we can. Now, by doing that, you can get little bits of merch. You can also get your book to sponsor this show, so you get to listen in the warm, safe knowledge that you're supporting the show that you love. I don't know if it is warm, safe knowledge, but I mean, it's warm and safe for me. It really helps me out. Thanks to everyone that has done that on Patreon, by the way. If you are waiting for merch, you should have it by now. Little bits of merch went all over the world last week. I mean, I stood in the line at the post office for ages, sending stuff to America and Australia and the UAE. If you have stuff, put my mind at ease, would you? Just send a little message to the contact page over at writersroutine.com. And if you want to be on the list of people I'm sending things to in the long line at the post office, help us out. Send what you can. Support us over at patreon.com/writersroutine. Remember, we are chatting to Ed Needham, the editor of the brilliant Strong Words magazine, in a little bit. Before we get to that, let's get back to it with Erin Kinsley talking about her new novel, Innocent. It's the story of a close-knit community that is torn apart when a celebrity is found murdered. Now, the celeb that she based it on is Nikki Campbell. If that doesn't mean anything to you, if you're not sure who Nikki is, he is a radio presenter from over here in the UK. He used to be on Radio 1, now he's on Radio 5 Live. He also does ethical debate shows on the telly on a Sunday morning. And I mean, nothing against him, please. Nicky's a very nice chap. But for some reason, the idea of his death inspired Erin to write a new book. You can hear why Erin thought about that in a little bit. Also, you can find out why she compares editing to knitting. And we pick things up talking about the discipline of storytelling. Sitting down every day to write. How long did it take to figure out how she works best?
I think a number of years, actually. I've had quite a long writing career, and in the beginning I was dabbling. I think that's where everybody starts. You know, you do start dabbling. I think people can expect too much of themselves too soon, I think. And I think I expected too much of myself too soon, probably. But I started with short stories, and there isn't as much discipline in a short story, obviously, because of the word count, you know. But that's where I started, and I would just wait for it to have an idea. And sometimes I'd wait weeks to have an idea. And the ideas would be okay, you know, and I'd produce these stories. And when I started to write my first novel, I think then it's a marathon, isn't it, rather than a sprint then. And I think fear becomes inspiring then, because you think, well, I want to do this, and I want to do this before a certain age. You know, you set yourself goals, don't you? And you just do the maths, and you think, well, if I need 80 or 100,000 words, if I only write 200 words a day, that's going to take me an awful long time to do. And I think it was being quite a logical person on one level that I thought, if I'm going to produce 80,000 words and I want to do it this year, which I think my original goal was to write a novel in a year, then really I need to have these targets. And I think I set myself targets quite early on, and I've just always stuck to that.
Because you're quite disciplined and you want to get at least 1,000 words down a day, and we spoke about your charts and your diagrams and your planning earlier on, how good are you at the planning and the plotting stage of writing a novel? When you sit down there at 8 o'clock in the morning, do you know exactly what you need to get through?
No, because I'm one of those immensely brave people who I rarely write to a synopsis. Very rarely. I start with an idea. I have written an entire novel based on a title, actually. But I think synopses have their place, I think. But I think they can be constraining, because once you get involved with your characters, inevitably, anyone would say this, they're going to go off in directions that you weren't expecting. And if you keep trying to pull them back to the plot line, you could lose something very precious doing that. And I think you've got to have a level of trust in yourself and your subconscious. And I do think that's something that comes with practice and experience. I don't think I would have said that when I was 21. I'm sure I wouldn't have said that. But I think as you gain more experience, you gain the ability to trust yourself and to know that it will work out fine. And even if you take a small wrong turn, that you can come back from that. You know, there's any book you're writing, you're going to throw away thousands upon thousands of words. I never throw mine away, actually. I keep them in Word files on the laptop and in my famous notebooks, you know, and nothing is ever wasted. But I'm never too rigid. I might have an idea where I'm hoping to go with a plot, but it might go somewhere entirely different. And if that happens, it's usually a better place.
So if you don't start out with a synopsis, what do you start out with? If sometimes on the show, writers will describe their plot to me like a roadmap. So they might know, well, they know where they're starting from. They might know where they're going, and maybe a few service stations along the way. How does it work for you?
Well, if we look at Found, because I think that's probably the easiest example, I had that key idea, you know, the idea of a child who is snatched and then returned. So I had an obvious place to start with, which was with the snatch itself. And that naturally led into the distress of the family. And that naturally led into the police arriving and taking charge of the investigation. And I knew that I was vaguely aiming towards the child being returned. So there's the first third of the book, really, pretty straightforward. What I didn't have after that was what was going to happen next. And I'd already written in a grandfather character in the opening scenes when the parents discover that the child is missing and the father calls his grandfather. And it was that character who began to talk to me at that point. But there's another example. The book I'm writing now, Hidden, which is the third Erin Kingsley book. I've got an idea for that, to the two sisters and a police investigation, and an overarching idea for that. Interestingly, the sisters have temporarily stopped talking to me. I don't know whether it was something I said or wrote or whatever. So I've now moved on to the police procedural aspect of it, and that is leading me forward. And every morning when I turn up in the caravan, I have a new idea for that. So that's what I'm working on. I'm not forcing the sisters to come out of hiding. They'll come out in their own good time. And it just comes down to trust and these developing new ideas. So every morning when I go and sit in the caravan, I tend to think, oh, okay, this is what should happen next. And that is what should happen next. And that's what happens. I had an image of a perfect idyllic country wedding. That was my first idea. And I thought, what if something went horribly wrong at your wedding? You know, because we all love a good wedding, don't we? And I had this image of this small town, this lovely small town. I used to live in a small town, and I kind of miss it, but it was a place that was full of gossip and secrets and all kinds of undercurrents that were going on there. It was intriguing, really, you know, in the kind of Miss Marple way. Miss Marple always said that all human life is there in St. Mary Mead, in that tiny village. And that was certainly true of the town that I lived in. So I was very drawn. I'd had this picture of the perfect country village and a perfect country wedding. And somebody being murdered there with a bottle of champagne, because I thought, you know, what's the ultimate weapon if you're at a wedding? Somebody gets hit over the head with a bottle of champagne, which sounds like kind of a cliche. I hope it's not cliched, you know, it's not Cozy Crime or whatever. And I had the idea of the character who was going to come to a bad end, and it was a TV presenter. And I was thinking, actually, the TV presenter I had in mind, I hope this is Nikki Campbell. Sorry, Nikki, you know, if you ever listen to this, but I had
this. I actually saw Nikki Campbell earlier today.
Really? Is that true? Cool.
At my other job, I didn't say hello to him, but at my other job, I kind of ran
into
him.
Isn't that synchronicity? There you go. But it was Nikki Campbell that I was thinking of. And in Innocent, it's kind of the Nikki Campbell character who gets hit over the head. So I've got my opening scene for that. But the question is, the big question always is, who done it? And then I had a range of characters that I was thinking of, an ex-policeman and various others. And I thought, I really wasn't sure when I started out who was going to have done it and motives, but as the book evolved, the motive became clear and the the killer became clear, and it evolved in that same kind of organic way.
So then I know that we've kind of touched upon this, but what needs to happen next before you start with your fountain pen getting down that very first sentence?
Well, what needs to happen next? I just think you just got to kind of get in the zone. I think for me, the process is very goal oriented, I think. It's easy to let time slip away. And I think it's just focusing and getting out of your own way and just being there and getting the words down on paper. That's all I can say about that part of the process, really. But, you know, as I said, it's all happening all the time. It's your brain is always working, no matter whatever I'm doing. My brain is always working, always developing new ideas, new characters, new ways of description. What happens further down the line, because when you're working like that, I think the words, frankly, are quite rough. My first drafts, you would not want to read my first drafts. And I think that's something else that I've learned, not to be afraid of a first draft that you wouldn't dare show to anybody, because, you know, the language is awful. It's, you know, it's a bit of a mess, repeated, and it doesn't hang together properly. But I think the biggest pleasure in it all for me comes when you're going through, when you've got a very rough first draft and you then are going through it, pulling it all together, straightening it out. It's kind of like, it's almost like making a quilt, really, to me. You know, when you start with all the pieces, don't you, of a quilt, and you start stitching, you pin them together first, and then you stitch them together, and gradually something something worthwhile begins to emerge. And that to me is the is going through the editing process. You know, you first edit and you think, well, okay, this is getting close to something I could show an editor. I would do loads of edits. I mean, I probably do 10 or 15 full edits on one of my books. It's just got to be perfect. But it's a...
What are you changing between... Sorry to interrupt. What are you changing between, say, the 12th and the 13th edit?
I'm usually working on the language, on the way my sentences are constructed, on the adjectives that I've used... just very nitty gritty on the descriptions. I don't tend to do a lot of description, but for that reason, because I think it slows it down and I like to keep the books quite pacey. But that means when you're picking an adjective, it's really got to earn its keep. And I think choosing those words, the perfect word, that is a very time consuming thing to do. And when I'm in full edit mode, it can take me a full day, just to do 3 pages. I mean, that's the kind of level that I'm working at then. So it's a very different process to what happens in the beginning when it's very speedy, you know, 1,000 words a day. It's very much slowed down when I get into the full editing process. And then it's very, very slow. And actually it drives me nuts because it can take, you know, it might take me two or three months to write Found. And then it probably took me twice as long as that to edit it and get it into publishable format.
Lastly, this might be quite quite a strangely philosophical one. I'm just thinking about you. You have this idea for a local celebrity that is murdered with a champagne bottle, a picture-perfect wedding in a picture-perfect community. Do you think somewhere you always know who has done it and you always know why they've done it? I know that you don't plot and you kind of write as you go on. You're a proper pantser. Is it there somewhere in your... kind of brushing the dirt off the hieroglyphics, or are you actually constructing this as you go along? I know that sounds a bit waffly, but...
I know exactly what you mean. And I think that's an excellent point, because I think on a subconscious level, yes, I do always know how it's done. And I can reference that by a book I wrote under a different name, when in the opening scenes, I was describing a little cabin, and in the opening scenes, I put a shotgun in this cabin. And I had no idea why I'd done that. And then way down the line, as I was getting to the closing scenes, it became crystal clear why that shotgun was there, and it was very much needed. But this was 3 or 4 months down the line. But I had subconsciously put that shotgun in there so that somebody down the line could pick it up. So I think your subconscious is always a lot smarter than you are, actually.
And that is it for our chat with Erin Kinsley this week. Thank you so much to her for coming on the show, for telling us how she wrote her brand new book, Innocent. If you fancy grabbing a copy, please use the link that is in the podcast notes over at writersroutine.com. And don't go anywhere. I know that's usually the point that you switch off, but please don't go anywhere. Now, a little bonus addition to the show, talking about the brilliant writing magazine, Strong Words. Now, I'll be honest, I'm not getting anything out of this. There is kind of talk that I'm going to go in there as well, but it's not a plug, a proper plug. I've not been sponsored to do it. I was just sent a copy of the magazine and I loved it. So I got the editor on the show. It's so beautifully and lovingly put together. It's got interviews in there. It's got reviews, articles, editorials. Strong Words is a writing magazine, I think, that as a reader actually works for you. Now, the whole thing is put together by Ed Needham, who is an old hand in the magazine business. And we caught up the other day. We had a chat online all about Strong Words. And he started off by telling me, rather generally, what it is.
It's a magazine about books for people who buy books for pleasure. So the intention is that, I mean, I love buying books. I love reading books, and also quite enjoyed reading book reviews. And it kind of struck me after, you know, reading book reviews that I wasn't really being given enough of a sense of just how many books there were. I wasn't getting enough of a sense of whether this book was for me. And too many reviewers, I felt, were either sort of grandstanding a little bit and showing how they like to display sort of greater knowledge of than the author by pointing out sort of tiny nitpicking little faults, or often reviewers got into it, you know, adopted a sort of academic tone that, you know, obviously, you know, plenty of books, plenty of journals and the like that are written for academics and intellectuals and people who take a very highbrow approach to literature and books. But for most people, that just goes completely over their heads. And so I wanted Strong Words to be about books, but not making books sound like homework.
That's a brilliant intention, but I'd imagine that's quite hard to do a lot of the time. When you are reviewing books, when you're reading so many, then trying to make your review utterly accessible to everyone. And I mean, it is quite a high concept magazine, so it's not like you've not properly dumbed things down, but you have made things accessible. How do you go about doing that without falling into the trap, as you've said, that so many critics do fall into and get into intellectual?
Well, I really want the reviews themselves to be a pleasure to read. You know, it shouldn't be like a steep climb. And so I take a fairly sort of journalistic approach to it. And by that, I mean, you know, you have to, you know, each sentence has to kind of earn its corn, you know, to make sure that people go on to the next sentence, you know, otherwise it's very easy for people to drift away, you know. So I try and make them as sort of lively and punchy as possible. I try and drag out the, you know, some of the interesting details from the book, quotes that, you know, really log in people's, register in people's minds, and try and make it, try and be as enthusiastic as I can, you know, rather than taking this sort of, I'm now going to settle back in a dusty armchair and steeple my fingers and tell me why you should or shouldn't read this book.
Tell me about the very first idea then, that the moment that the idea for Strong Words came to you. I mean, we kind of have been around the houses with it earlier on, but like, what was the very spark of an idea, that light bulb moment that you thought, okay, yeah, I'm going to give this a go?
Well, look, I mean, I've worked in magazines all my life, and it's the only, I don't know how to do anything else. You know, I'm a journalist and magazine editor, and the, you know, technology is sort of magazine production has progressed to the point where it's possible for a really high quality consumer magazine to be made by a very small number of people. So I thought, well, how small can that number be? You know, I mean, just going back 20 or 30 years, it used to require enormous editorial staff, sales staff, production staff, and then all these kind of pre-press people who, you know, the technical people who prepared the pages. But now I wanted to find out how low could I get that number? And I've effectively got it down to one, which is just me. So I produce it, I write it myself, I produce it myself. And the only sort of external assistance I require is of a designer. I'm not sufficiently skilled to actually lay out the pages myself, although I can put copy into a template. So I have a designer for a couple of weeks per issue. And so I thought when the sort of magazine industry decided it was pretty much going to sort of lie down by the side of the road and wait for the end, you know, it's been pretty much, flattened by the rise of digital technology and social media, and advertising has kind of left the publishing industry to the extent it's very difficult for magazines to survive. So I thought, well, look, I don't know how to do anything else. I'm going to try and do a magazine on my own because I feel I can. So if I'm going to do a magazine on my own, what am I going to do it about? And it was going to have to be something that I could devote all my time to, because it does take 7 days a week to produce this thing. I have no days off. And so it had to be something which I was genuinely interested in. And books, reading books and writing about books and talking about books is something that I, you know, even having done this for kind of two and a bit years now, I still have just as much enthusiasm for as the day I started. So I feel I've chosen the right subject.
Now, I don't like listening to interviews where the interviewer takes about 10 minutes to answer a question. And I know the listeners of the podcast are guffawing at that right now. But this kind of requires it because, yeah, I mean, you just touched on in your last answer how we're led to believe that the magazine industry particularly is dying. And you said you work 7 days a week on it. In the PR that I was given about you, you read the equivalent of War and Peace every week. You write the equivalent of The Great Gatsby every month. So I guess very simply, like, why? why do you do it? So many people in your experience, like back in the day, who worked on magazines as you have, may have given up the ghost and gone off and just got a regular job. Why are you persisting with this? Why do you do it all?
Well, because I feel there is a business here. You know, I do it because I feel there is an opportunity to, you know, even though the magazine industry is, you know, been sort of frightened to death by the way in which digital technology and social media has completely eaten its lunch. There is still a lot of activity in sort of niche markets in magazines. So where people are really interested in specific activities, then there's quite a lot going on. You know, the magazine is still a viable format for people to get their information, and I think they like, you know, people like to belong to something. They like to think they're being given something which is made, or they're buying something which is made specifically for them. And it's, you know, so there's a sense of belonging, there's a sense of usefulness, there's a sense of it being genuinely entertaining. And from my perspective, it's a way of making a living.
Now, this is a writer's podcast called Writer's Routine. It would be remiss of me not to try and touch on yours. I'm very curious, if you're doing this 7 days a week, it's really all consuming. How do you go about planning and then putting together every month's episode? So I guess take me through a month in the life of working on Strong Words. When do you first get the ideas of what you're going to focus on in next month? When are you starting to read? When are you starting to write? Take me through that, Ed.
So look, I do 9 issues a year, which is, it sounds like a slightly perverse number, but it's halfway between 6 and 12, which are two fairly conventional you know, magazine sort of outputs. But it's about an issue every six weeks, which is, as I can't do them any quicker than that on my own. You know, it's just too much. So so I kind of start pretty much with a blank sheet of paper at the beginning of every six weeks, and I go through all the publishers' catalogues, which are all available online, and just get a sense of what's coming up. The magazine has a fairly established format, so I know that I'm looking for, you know, so many novels, so many nonfiction books, so many interviews, so many biographies and memoirs, so many graphic novels, and try and fill the spaces with what looks most interesting, and make sure I've got a good breadth and variety of writers and from different countries and so on, and then just go about trying to fill those spaces. So I wake up very early in the morning. I wake up at about 5:30. That's not quite right. 6:15. And I walk for an hour and a half and listen to audiobooks. So I tend to stay over at my girlfriend's house during the week. So I walk back to my house where I work, start at about 8:00 in the morning. Read, write. Make sure that books are coming in and interviews and so on are being organized, do them, transcribe them. And then in the evening, I walk back to my girlfriend's house for another hour and a half back and listen to some more audiobooks. So it's not that complicated. You know, it's just a great volume of work. I try and ensure that the quality is kept high. I try and ensure that it's kept interesting. And then in the last 2 weeks of the process, I get the designer in and we actually lay out the pages and sub the pages and put the headlines in and send it off to the printer.
Now, I've got in front of me issue 20, which was from July. I imagine if they're every 6 weeks, this is the last edition that you had. What's in the new edition? What's coming up in the future that you can tell us about?
Well, I don't know if you're interested in dates on your podcast, but today I think is that we're in the last sort of last week of August, and so there's a new issue coming out this week, which has the Secret Barrister on the cover, and obviously his or her first book was anonymous, a gigantic success about how people don't so misunderstand the way the law operates in Britain. It puts them at a massive disadvantage. And this new Secret Barrister book is called Fake Law, and it's about the way in which people's legal rights are being so undermined by government and special interests that were they ever to go and you know, seek legal redress, they may well find their what they thought were their legal rights aren't there anymore. So it's quite an important book, and I'm quite pleased that we have a good interview with the secret barrister in that next issue. And there's a lot of there's also sort of big section which the secret barrister is part of, which is called Going It Alone. And so I've talked to a number of people who are the who have kind of, you know, done their thing on their own. So one of those people is the absolutely fabulous Raina Wynn, who did The Salt Path, which is another massive hit. Her new book, The Wild Silence, is out about, you know, she became unexpectedly homeless and lost everything. And so she started out with her only possession, a tent, to walk the Southwest Coast Path. And this is, and, you know, reconnected with life. And so this is after that. And rather it being a sort of, you know, jubilant return to normality, it's actually quite melancholy and thoughtful, and thinking, well, what is, you know, it's very difficult to return to life after you've become homeless. Even if you've got a roof over your head, it's still very difficult to trust people and have faith in all the things you kind of took for granted before. So that's a very moving thing as well. And then there's also the first female football writer, Julie Welch, has written about the old days on Fleet Street and breaking into this very male, beery, sort of rather sexist world, which she, even though it's difficult, she has a great deal of nostalgia for.
Thank you so much to Ed for telling us all about Strong Words. You can find out more about the mag over at writersroutine.com. And thank you so much for listening. It's been a bumper episode this week. Find out everything on the website. While you're there, get in touch with the show on the contact form. Let us know any notes and queries and questions and observations and thoughts that you might have. Also, you can support us over at Patreon, patreon.com/writersroutine. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and follow us on Twitter. We are at writerspod on there too. Now, next week, we're chatting to Callum McSwiggan all about his travel memoir. It's called Eat Gay Love, which is an amazing title, and it's a brilliantly funny book as well. We're chatting to Callum next week on the show. I will see you then with another Writer's Routine. Bye!
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.